Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Daniel Wilson. He's the author of a very amusing and very provocative and educational book called How to Survive a Robot Uprising. Tell us first the traditional question. How did you decide to write a book about this topic?
Well, it's not a huge leap. I've spent the last 5 years getting a PhD in robotics at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And so the genesis of this book was really a few pitchers of beer and me and my friends getting a little bit belligerent about the fact that robots are usually portrayed negatively in the media, whereas we see, you know, the benevolent aspects of robots every day at school. So I thought, well, I'm a roboticist. Why not take Hollywood seriously and give serious advice for all these sort of situations that are almost a cliche by now in Hollywood?
So the kinds of situations you're imagining are like the Terminator scenario where the World Wide Web wakes up and starts to kill all humans with a variety of robots.
Right, yeah. So there are a whole lot of different... basically, for every robot you have, there's a scenario that's been covered where it goes apey and starts mauling people.
But your book is fascinating because it is, in fact, an introduction to what the current state of robotic research is and what the various kinds of abilities and weaknesses are of various kinds of robots.
And yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, that's kind of that's pretty much the reason I wrote it. What I found was that most people, the scope of their knowledge about robots is limited to pretty much what they see in movies and on television, and usually, you know, so what they know about robots, you know, the Terminator, and so I kind of took all those situations that people already know about, and introduced the current prototypes, you know, that are really out there. So hopefully a person picks up the book having seen the Terminator or Star Wars, you know, and they're thinking a Terminator is Arnold. And they put it down and they say, well, the Terminator is a humanoid robot with a bipedal gait, you know, probably passive dynamic motors, you know, things like that. So that would be my goal.
Let's talk about those different kinds of robots. You talk about robotic applications in consumer goods and in automation and land-based mobile robots and all kinds of things. So what are some of the major categories of robots and kind of general definition? Because there's AI, there's various kinds of computing in almost everything that we use nowadays.
Yeah, so the way I define a robot at the beginning, there is no set definition, but what I use is the sense-think-act paradigm. So I define a robot as any sort of mechanical artifact that can sense the environment and then think about what to do, come to some idea about how to, you know, decide what to do in the world, and then act, and so then actually do something in the world. So that's a pretty loose definition, and, you know, the artifacts don't necessarily have to be, you know, physical, located in the world, you know, in order to sort of qualify as a robot in there. But the robot forms that I cover, I cover humanoid robots. I cover biologically inspired robots. So these are robots that are modeled off of cockroaches, flies, lizards, geckos, lobsters. I cover unmanned vehicles. So there are unmanned ground vehicles. There are unmanned, you know, airplanes and boats. And let's see. Oh, nanorobots, although those don't really exist much yet. And I also cover modular robots, which are robots that are made up of, you know, dozens or thousands of identical parts, but they can configure themselves into almost any shape. And I also talk a little bit about artificial intelligence algorithms, basically like data mining algorithms. So those would be computer programs that figure out what you want to buy from Walmart, you know.
The field of robotics has developed a lot more slowly than people imagined back in the 60s and 70s. You know, you look back at the extrapolations even of computer scientists, much less of science fiction, and we aren't quite there yet. What's been the major weakness or stumbling block of the development of these of robust robotic systems?
Yeah, I think, you know, back in the day, back in the 60s, everybody sort of underestimated how hard it would be, because we were all making decisions based on our own experiences. We were judging how hard it would be based on how hard it would. We were judging how hard tasks would be for robots based on how hard they are for us. And what we found is that what's easy for us is really hard for robots, and vice versa. So that's why they can beat us at chess, you know, but they can't, very few of them can juggle or something like that. They definitely can't do the things that a 2-year-old human can do. So that underestimation from the beginning caused people to make a lot of wild claims, you know. So now that's where really where research is focused, is on letting robots do all these things that we can do, like recognize speech or recognize faces or emotions or gestures. And then there's also a lot of work in locomotion, you know, how to make a robot walk like a person, but also any type of locomotion you can think of, from hummingbird hovering to snakes that wiggle, snakes that swim, almost anything you can think of. So those are two areas where there's a lot of research right now. And those are areas that people thought wouldn't be such a big challenge, but now we're just hitting it, you know.
One of the examples you give in the book of if you're trying to escape from a robot is you run up to something that's roughly the same shape and size that you are and hold on to it for a second and then run away in a different direction.
Yeah.
And the visual processing power that it takes, that we take for granted, of being able to distinguish one object from another, it would get confused, or the assumption
right.
would be that, that would be the kind of thing that would confuse a contemporary robot.
Uh-huh. So yeah, that's how to fool a vision-based target tracker, and you know, so that's a robot that's using a camera to track people, and just like people, a robot has to use whatever information it can in order to figure out what it's trying to figure out. So to a robot using a camera, what the information it has is usually shape and color, and a lot of times there's a motion model, so it can predict where you're going to be next, and so it sort of bases where it's going to look for you based on where it thinks you're going. So if you know, and it knows how fast a human can run and all the different ways a human can move. So grabbing a comrade, if you're wearing similar colors of clothing, and if you suddenly merge into a shape that's indistinct, it doesn't look like two humans, it doesn't look like one human, and then you run in another direction, what you get is you introduce a lot of ambiguity into that calculation. So vision trackers are going to be probabilistic, so it's going to have a 50-50 idea of who's who. Now, what's interesting is sometimes robots can use features they can use information that we don't necessarily know is there. So, for instance, if that robot was using a thermal image tracking camera, then it could be looking at, you know, your heat signatures, and you may have a different heat signature if you've been running more. Maybe you're more hot than your comrade. So you never do know, you know. But to fool a vision-based target tracker, that's what the experts say to do.
Have you gotten any response from people in the defense establishment? Because there is actually quite a bit of research being done and application being done of the use of robotics in the field to, for instance, bomb dismantling or bomb handling, and going into buildings where there might be terrorists and even armed robots that could shoot a terrorist in a building so that you don't put soldiers in harm's way. Some of the things that you talk about in this book would actually be a good primer if you're trying to avoid a system like that.
Yeah, some of the sections are more relevant to that kind of those kinds of topical things than other sections. So, you know, the section on how to reason with an evil robot, maybe not that useful to people right now. How to fool face recognition could be useful, right? Or knowledge about unmanned aerial vehicles could be useful. And as it turns out, there is a lot of DARPA funding and DoD funding for robotics in those areas, and you know, I did end up talking to roboticists who are funded through those routes, and I talked to a lot of roboticists that aren't. And I did I spoke to a few defense contractors as well. I've worked in the past at Northrop Grumman, which is a big defense contractor, and you know, so I got some of my information directly from those people, but I haven't noticed any I haven't had any problems or any nothing's come up that has to do with that, you know. It was just more information. It's all public.
Men in black haven't come to your door and demanded your manuscripts.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Well, for the most part, the book is couched in the robot uprising scenarios. So those, I don't think, it's so fanciful that I don't think those really make anybody, any men in black, raise their eyebrows, you know?
I'm speaking with Daniel Wilson. He's the author of How to Survive a Robot Uprising. You talk in the book about some of the A-Life experiments, the attempt to create robots that are shaped like cockroaches or biomimetic in various ways. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of debate in the AI circles about why AI hasn't progressed as fast as it might have otherwise. And some people are suggesting that it's precisely by modeling the most rudimentary aspects of life and allowing life to kind of robotic life to evolve from those rudimentary aspects that we would eventually get to the more robust kinds of intellectual capabilities that we imagine. In the first place, do you have an opinion about whether strong AI is ever going to come about? And if it is something that could come about, do you think that these top-down kind of cognitive models or these A-life models are more fruitful avenues to produce those kinds of artificial intelligence that we have imagined for so long?
Good question. A big one. So, basically, I don't see any reason why strong AI could not happen. But the first thing that you have to do is you'd have to define exactly what strong AI is and how you would measure it and know if it was really there. And, you know, that can be tough. So, I mean, if you're just saying strong AI is when you can't tell the difference between, you know, a robot and a person, then, I think that's certainly something that can eventually happen. Now, the motivation for making that happen is not clear to me. So there are a lot of weak AI research areas where you say, look, if I get this done, I'm going to be saving people's lives, you know, or I'm going to have some new product that's killer. Now, if you're talking about, hey, look, I've spent $10 billion developing this strong AI. It sits in a jar, and what it really likes to do is it likes to talk about Shakespeare or, you know, whatever the hell it wants to do. I don't know who's going to give you $10 billion to develop that. But I do think that it's possible. And in terms of whether you want to hit the problem from a top-down approach or a bottom-up approach, I kind of believe that you're going to have to use both. So one example is it's not so much of a conceptual problem, but it's just, for instance, how to make a cockroach walk, right? A cockroach robot, or how to make anything walk, for that matter. And what you see some people that say, well, we need to know exactly where to put the leg, and we need to have some sort of symbolic approach where there's an abstraction of maybe a simulated terrain, and you're figuring out exactly what joint angles you need and where to put the foot to maximize this and minimize that. And that's really hard. And then you look at a roach and you say, well, it isn't thinking very much, and it's cruising, you know. I think if a human was the size of a roach, we would be running around at 200 miles an hour or something. That's the equivalent. I'm sorry, if a roach were as big as a human. So one solution is to go from the bottom up and to say, okay, well, we're going to encapsulate the intelligence here by building a really smart leg. So this leg, whenever you slap it onto the ground, will bend just right, and it will, you know, it will catch the ground just right so that it's the most efficient leg possible. And that's kind of what the cockroach has, is just through a lot of evolution, it's got really good legs, and it just basically mentally only has to throw them around, you know. Now, that's fine for a cockroach. For a more complicated ape, you know, you're going to need some symbolic information as well. And then, of course, on an even higher level, to figure out where you're going or why you're doing anything, you know, path planning, you know, that's going to also require some of the more symbolic artificial intelligence. So I'm really glad to see that people are doing research in both areas. And what I especially like is whenever, you know, those two areas are combined and you get a synthesis.
Well, one of the distinctions between the strong AI idea that you addressed and the weak AI is that weak AI is generally expert systems that are extensions, that are machines that are extensions of human intent. And the idea of a strong AI embodies some notion of self-will, that we would be right. Able to... just as, you know, human beings and animals have a desire for self-preservation, that these robots would have within them some kind of desire of self-will and self-preservation, which leads automatically to the notion of a robot uprising.
Yeah, well, the definitions, they're kind of it's kind of blurry, right? So let's say you make a Roomba. Well, how about, let's talk about Roomba. Roomba will not go downstairs. It won't fall down the stairs. The reason is because people pay $200 for Roombas and they don't want the damn thing to fall down the stairs. So the question is, when the Roomba senses that the stairs are there and it says, ooh, I'm not going down there, you know, is it acting to preserve itself? I mean, it's certainly not self-aware. So, I mean, that's just a built-in feature, right? I would say the Roomba uses some rudimentary artificial intelligence, which you could call weak AI, to figure out how to vacuum a room, you know? And so in some places you see how the definition is a little blurry there.
Absolutely. Well, you also mentioned nanobots, and I don't know if you saw last week, the most simple bacteria, self-reproducing organism was sequenced. It was an ocean bacterium, only had 1,300 genes and the fewest number of base pairs of anything that had ever been sequenced. And it makes me think, and other people think, that at the nano level, we may soon be able to have some kind of convergence between genetic engineering and nanomaterial engineering that would actually create nanobots. Talk to anybody doing nanobot research?
The thing is, I did. I talked a little bit about nanorobotics to people. And the fact is that nanorobotics is still really in its infancy. We're just now figuring out how to move things around on that scale, you know, much less building a whole functioning robot, and much, much less than actually building a robot that's capable of reproducing itself. But I think you're right. That's a really interesting point that you bring up, that on the nanoscale, mechanical artifacts are really in baby land compared to what is happening organically all the time and has been for billions of years, I guess. I just actually wrote an article for Popular Mechanics where I was checking out this these organic-like plastic muscles that are at MIT. There's been some new theory developed at MIT that says that these organic muscles can actuate much faster than they could before, which means they're going from 1,000 times slower than a person to 100 times faster than a person. But the interesting point was that the main application area of these muscles is not to build, you know, hulking bodybuilder robots, but it's to actually shrink these things down to the nanoscale to have a functioning actuator, you know, on a nanoscale. And the fact is that it looks very organic. It's much closer to an organic muscle than, say, a robot, than say, a motor is, you know. I guess I can see how there may be a synthesis in the future there, at least on a nanoscale.
I'm speaking with Daniel Wilson. He's the author of How to Survive a Robot Uprising, which is a guide to the current state of robotic research. And this is Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. One of the ideas that has been broached in the science fiction literature for many years is the notion that if we actually did have functioning AI and robots in our society, that we would want to encode them with some kind of moral code or legal code that would keep them from violating human interests, keep them from a robot uprising. What's your take on the notion of Asimov's law? Do you think that it's inherently problematic because anything that's smart enough to pose us a threat would actually be able to overturn its own laws?
Well, this is a key aspect of any machine that you design. Safety first, right? So at this point, I don't think there are consumer robots that can really hurt people. Maybe there are some lawnmowers that could, but I'm sure they're set up so that, you know, they won't chop anybody's fingers off. And prototypes, however, are a different story. So there are a lot of dangerous robot prototypes that are in labs and in universities. And the first line of defense on any robot that you're going to see, if you go to a university or you go to the DARPA Grand Challenge, you see all those unmanned ground vehicles, you know, they're great big Humvees. The first thing you're going to see, or maybe not see, but it's the emergency stop, right? Every robot that's dangerous has one, and it's sometimes a physical button that you can hit, or it's a wireless button that you can hit, and it just shuts off the robot, you know. So if I'm going to extrapolate into the future, and I'm imagining consumer robots that are possibly dangerous, right? So if there's say it catches a virus, or say somebody teleoperates it and decides to do something bad, then, you know, we're going to see these kinds of emergency stops and things like that. The other thing is when you've got a robot that's potentially dangerous, the first thing you need to know is whether it's malfunctioning or not, right? You need to know this robot has gone crazy, right? So one thing I've noticed from movies, which I really liked, was there's this movie, iRobot, you know, which was a fun movie. And in this movie, there are humanoid servant robots. And there's a scene where there's an elderly woman. I think she's in her kitchen, and she's got this robot that's kind of gone nuts, right? And so it turns around, and she asks it for toast or something. And it turns around and looks at her, and it's got these red glowing eyes. You know, and I thought, wow, that designer really did this old lady a favor, right? By putting in these red glowing eyes, the internal state of the robot is transparent. This is a crazy robot, you know. Forget about the toast. Run away. And so, you know, revealing internal state through means that a human can understand intuitively, for instance, glowing red eyes, instead of maybe a digital readout that says evil, malevolent robot, you know, that's key. So really, e-stops and the intuitive revealing of internal states are going to be a couple of key areas for practical robotics, you know, when a robot could be dangerous.
When in the movie The Terminator, Skynet wakes up and turns on the global defense net and starts to whack humanity really hard. Yeah. But one of the ideas that that some people who are concerned about self-willed AI emerging as an emergent property of the global communications web. Is that, you know, that there could be various kinds of artificial life like worms and viruses that would evolve into some kind of phenomenon, perhaps not fully self-aware in the sense that we would recognize, but that would become increasingly sophisticated and become some kind of a threat to humanity. Do you know, we have currently the Symantec antivirus and all these other systems, a kind of a global immune system for the information
right.
network. But do you think that, given what you know about robotics, that those are adequate preparations for increasingly sophisticated emergent properties of information systems?
Yeah, well, so this is going to have to be a key area in any future consumer robotics endeavors, because for now, let's say somebody, what do they have these terms that are really provocative? The zombie computers, right? So your computer has succumbed to a virus, and now it is a zombie, and it is emailing and doing whatever this crazy spammer or whoever wants it to do. That's fine. That's no fun. Now, what if your grandma has a robot in her house that takes care of her? You know, if this thing gets hacked, well, I mean, there are a lot of really bad scenarios that can unfold from that. And so no, you know, I mean, there are going to have to be increased safeguards in the future for places where we've got robots that are doing a lot of good, but they're in precarious positions, you know, especially when they have positions in our daily lives, you know.
Okay, my last question, and it's going to be a big one, is has to do with the notion of the singularity. And I don't know if you've ever read Werner Vinge's classic essay on the singularity. He wrote it for NASA back in 1993. And he proposed that because computing power was doubling, according to Moore's law, every 18 months, that we would eventually get to the point where we would have these human-level calculating machines on our desks, and at some point they would all wake up, and you would have this robot uprising scenario. But the point that most people don't recognize about that essay is the second part of his argument, which is that intelligence augmentation of human beings was the principal way to prevent and to forestall that kind of robot uprising. So
yeah.
You just wrote an article about, for instance, artificial muscles, and mm-hmm. you know, those have potential applications for prosthetic limbs and so forth. And we have human beings who now have direct brain-to-machine interfaces and
right.
are able to control various kinds of robotics directly from their thinking. When you look forward, it's not just about robots out there. It's also about robots inside our bodies, the nanorobots, the robots connected to our brains and so forth. Do you think that, you know, I know that your book is satirical and tongue-in-cheek, but do you think that, you know, that this is a realistic way to think about the problem of augmentation of human beings and extension of human capacities as one way to stay at one step ahead of our machines.
So, yeah, and in fact, in the book, I have a section where I advise people on cochlear implants to improve your hearing, vision implants, prosthetic limbs, brain-machine interfaces, and all that stuff. And, you know, I think that the line is something like, when when hundreds of human Marines go into battle with grinding exoskeletons, you know, against the robots, just remember which team to root for, right? If you can, you know, if you can keep it straight. So the thing is, the singularity is definitely interesting. So, and I don't think that it's impossible, but I do think that it's really unlikely. If you're going to be worried about things, be worried about people, right? When people get a hold of this kind of technology, I think they'll be much more dangerous and even much more likely to be malevolent, you know, than a robot would, even if it did become aware, which is not, you know, definitely going to happen. So, you know, if you've got everybody gearing up and, you know, improving their mental faculties, improving their physical abilities, you know, through robotics, and they're gearing up in order to be able to stay one step ahead of an imaginary robot menace, how long is it before they start looking at each other, you know? you know, I don't want somebody jumping, you know, into my house and coming in through the roof and wrecking up the place with their robotic exoskeleton. So just make that point. But I definitely think that there's great potential for us to improve our bodies and our minds by using this robotic technology, you know? And, I mean, we invented all of these sensors that the robots use and all the AI algorithms that they use. And, you know, why shouldn't we be able to use them, too?
That's a great answer, Daniel. And what are you working on next?
I am right now doing the occasional article for Popular Mechanics, and I'm writing another book, and I'm interviewing for jobs since I just got out of school. It's time to get a real job, although the book is much more fun, I think.
Well, I hope that having written such a popular book doesn't screw up your academic job prospects.
It's really interesting. Most people, whenever they finish their PhD, they go and give job talks. And as soon as I finished my PhD, I went out and to the same places, to Microsoft Research. I'm going to Google soon. And I gave book talks, you know. They're not going to get me a job, that's for sure. But they might get some people interested in the book, and so that's good, too.
Well, it is a hilarious book, and I recommend it to everyone, and it's a very educational book as well. It's How to Survive a Robot Uprising, and I've been speaking to the author, Daniel Wilson. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.